Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of the Iditapod. I'm your host, Casey Grove, here at Alaska Public Media. In this episode, we have an interview with the Iditarod's new CEO, Rob Urbach. He's not new exactly, having been hired back in July, and of course, there's a ton of work that goes into the Iditarod well before the race starts. But this year's race will be Urbach's first as CEO, and he'll be the first to admit he's been learning a lot and still has a lot to learn probably in that role as things get moving down the trail from Anchorage to Nome. We recorded this interview in our studio in Anchorage toward the end of January. We figured that Urbach would be pretty busy closer to the race. We talked about some of the controversy the Iditarod has experienced in recent years, some criticisms of the race, and a lot about what the race is trying to accomplish in 2020, including the talking points that we've heard Iditarod officials hammering home. That's showcasing their dog care, highlighting their appreciation of dog mushing culture, and working to refresh the Iditarod brand. And I'll just say, from my perspective, Urbach seems to have a pretty detailed understanding of the challenges the Iditarod faces, as well as its successes. Urbach came to the Iditarod after 6 years as CEO of USA Triathlon. Previously, he had worked in sports marketing and management. Anyway, now he's the CEO of the Iditarod. I asked him first about how he got the job and what his qualifications are. Here is Rob Urbach.
Well, it's quite an interesting story, actually. I first came to Alaska about 20 years ago. I was on a flight with Susan Lucci, who I didn't know who it was, but she's evidently a soap opera star, and struck up a conversation. You know, what do you do? I was coming here. I was going to ski Alyeska and for the adventure, and she was coming for the Iditarod. And so since then, being in the sports business, was a fan from afar. But after I started to understand how colossal the event is, I was in all of the event that teams, mushers, dogs could go from Anchorage to Nome, you know, 24/7 through the night, through incredible broad weather conditions, and have to navigate and get there as quick as they can and safely get there. I was very impressed with the event, so I started to follow it, started to pay attention to the Iditarod as a fan. Then after at USA Triathlon, you know, I had a 6.5 year leadership stint there. There's some similar issues, believe it or not. So the Iditarod, you know, there's been some issues with dog health in the Iditarod. There's issues with people in triathlons. There's roughly 10 to 12 people will die in triathlons over the course of the year. It sounds like a lot, but that's spread over 3,000 events. But even so, one is too many. So I'd put together a team of prominent, you know, cardiologists and trauma people and life-saving people to understand, to see if we could find out and isolate what some of the commonalities were to prevent anything more from happening in the future. So put together a whole panel around that and came up with a doctrine called shared responsibility, and we found some trends, were able to address that to minimize those risks. So looking to do the same thing with the Iditarod. So I had that skill set. There was a scandal with the doping world and dealt with that, putting in whole anti-doping provisions, running an Olympic-level program that has a very sophisticated 24/7 whereabouts program to try to prevent or catch people that are cheating with performance-enhancing drugs and substances. So I had that ability. You know, I had big event expertise, oversaw roughly 4,000 events a year, had put on world championships, had been a delegate to the International Federation of the Sport of Triathlon, so had already traveled around the world looking at best practices, and had a passion for sports and all of the Iditarod, and a pretty unique skill set that I hope was brought in for the right reasons.
And I want to talk to you about some of that other stuff in a minute, but I also just kind of a basic question. I don't know how often you meet people that just like have never heard of the Iditarod or dog mushing, but if you do, how do you explain what the Iditarod is to somebody like that, and also what your role in it is?
Sure. I mean, I think that part is really to explain what the Iditarod is really honoring the importance and its place in the culture in the circumpolar region. So the notion this was basic transportation that allowed subsistence hunting and trap lines and survival. And of course, it goes back, some of the origins date back to the famous 1925 serum run that saved lives of the kids in Nome, which there's been a number of stories and a couple movies out about that right now. But the Iditarod really is there to preserve that culture, to honor those dogs, those people that really made Alaska what it is in terms of being able to live in a fairly remote place off the road system where you couldn't fly, you certainly couldn't drive, and the only way to get around was fire dog team.
So you mentioned this already, but in recent years, there's been what was called a dog doping scandal, and that led to one of the race's biggest stars kind of boycotting it. And, you know, there was a strained relationship between the mushers and the board and kind of accusations of a conflict of interest with some people. Some major sponsors pulled out. Is it fair to say that the Iditarod's had to deal with some controversy recently? And how would you describe that?
That's totally fair. You know, most of that occurred, before my tenure started. So, but nevertheless, still dealing with some of the ramifications of some of those challenges. There's been a new board put in place that is less conflict-driven, competency-based. We have some excellent board members who are members of the, you know, elite business community here in Alaska, who have a lot of foresight to put in to what are the values of the Iditarod. First and foremost, exemplary dog care. Secondly, you know, honoring the culture. And, you know, this is what we just talked about a minute ago in terms of preserving, you know, the importance and the values and the cultural relevancy of the sport of mushing into our great Alaskan communities. And the third is, you know, refreshing the brand. And that's, you know, a bit of a challenge given some of those obstacles that happened in the past. But that's all in the rear mirror mostly. You know, we're putting in place, we're a thought leader in terms of animal welfare, in terms of relevancy, in terms of what we represent. You know, Alaska is a very hot topic in the lower 48. I don't know how many reality shows there are about it, but nothing symbolizes more iconic and more authentic than the sled dog racing, than the Iditarod, and the people and the teams in our community.
I've heard people say that the Iditarod essentially got too big for its britches, and I wonder, do you think that's true, and is that part of the reason some of these changes have been made?
I'm not sure where that's directed at. It's I've heard criticisms that it's too much of a race, it's too slick, it's too fast. It's all about the speed. Pushes through the villages where before the villages were more part of the race, and now no one wants to stop because they want to all get to the finish line quicker. So it may have lost some of that community feel. So if that's part of it, I think there was just some fair points there that we're doing things to address that, to rejuvenate those community engagement levels. But being too big for its britches, I don't think so. We're from an organizational standpoint, we're still relatively small. We punch above our weight. I think we bring a lot of inspiration to Alaskans or people around the world, a lot of aspiration. You know, I think today's world where kids are growing up with their thumbs, you know, the Iditarod is kind of the anecdote to that, to visualize someone out there having that level of self-reliance, that level of ingenuity. I mean, to be an Iditarod racer, you have to be part adventurer, part super well-trained, part dog master, dog whisperer, part meteorologist, part MacGyver. And at some point along that trail, something's going to happen you never anticipated. So you're going to laugh along the way, you're going to cry along the way, but you're going to smile.
And I think I appreciate you saying that because I think that's all valid. And, when I've heard that criticism, I think it's more in a management sense that, like, you know, there were dog mushers in this race that kind of got into sort of management roles with it that were sort of bigger than them, you know. And so I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think that the new board has brought in a lot of professional competency. Given the makeup of our board, we have one of the leading lawyers in town, one of the leading marketing executives. We have people that really understand the complexity. You know, we our internet, our Iditarod Air Force, you know, we're 30 pilots flying 659 sorties. And what we do, people outside of Alaska, it's really hard to comprehend how complicated this race is. So what our sophistication is needed in terms of just getting our supplies up the trail. I mean, we're going where there's no roads, so we're flying in communication, satellite, food, generators, safety, people, volunteers, dogs. We're setting up our supply chain in 26 checkpoints on our 1,000-plus-mile trail, and that requires a pretty heavy level of sophistication. At the same time, you know, we put together a really good broadcast on an internet protocol, our insider broadcast. It's amazing what we get off the course. It's also a complicated dynamic. You've got an 800-pound, you would know more about that, would fly pack and all kinds of ways to get our signal off the court from remote places, and you know, landing planes where the pilots understand how to different levels of snow and ice, and managing all the differential in weather. So it's a pretty complicated event from a supply chain standpoint. So you really need sophisticated management. And granted, you know, mushers know how to do it. They've been on the trail, et cetera. But dealing with media, dealing with sponsors, dealing with the volunteers, dealing with veterinarians, managing through to put best practices forward, requires a different level of management expertise and complexity.
Let's talk PETA. We've heard that you met with them, and that seems like a really different approach than in the past for the Iditarod. So how did that go? And what does the Iditarod have to gain from having a dialogue with a group that just seems unable to accept any version of long-distance dog mushing?
Sure. So, you know, what I've said publicly, and I think I've demonstrated that we're open to looking at what their concerns are. So I did travel to PETA's L.A. headquarters. And also wanted to set the record straight on various allegations that they've had. But I have said, I'll continue to say, if there's something they can show us that's will improve the welfare of a sled dog, well, listen, we're open to it. Unfortunately, that's, not their objective. You know, they, traffic in allegations that are not rooted in the truth. They misrepresent, having their own dog handlers on the payroll people come into kennels and try to orchestrate, negative aspects of dog care. It is really a misrepresentation. And so I've, I'm happy to, I've offered to participate in an independent review panel. In fact, I just came from a meeting, a phone meeting with several veterinarians that we don't know, that aren't affiliated with us, because I've challenged them to look at all of our rules, all of our protocols. You know, should we have, different tests on at different ratios? What's our rest run ratio look like? Is that the right way to do it? What are our kennel standards like? Challenging on reality is important. And invited PETA to be a part of that. But PETA, they basically said they want to shut down the Iditarod. They don't want the Iditarod to exist. And they're really shown their intolerance, their inability to have any objectivity. And they're clearly aren't interested in really a dialogue about animal welfare.
Do you regret having met with them?
No. I think, at some point in time, there may be something that we could share. We're going to be a thought leader. We know more about canine fitness than any organizations from a physiological standpoint, from a cardiovascular standpoint. And we're in the process of disseminating information for the average pet owner. And PETA wants to, put our content on their website to show what a best practice is for, training your dog to run a 5K with you is what we're going to do. We're going to bring that out to the world. Then great. We have a relationship, and they aren't very polite and nice in how they proceed, and we're going to do what we do irrespective of how PETA responds in terms of creating more content that'll be valuable to pet owners around the world. We're continuing to study the physiology and health. We have alliances with numerous university-based veterinarians. PETA did challenge. They challenged tethering in kennels. I said, great. Let's look at that. I'm happy to do a research project on tethering versus pens. And the research that exists now, it's fairly unclear. There has been some that's done. Essentially, in fact, the research does conclude that it may be worse off having dogs in pens because they don't have their own personal space. It's a different dynamic. The way the tethering the pens and the houses are structured, I'm interested in looking at what's the optimum way to enhance that dog's welfare. Our Iditarod dogs are arguably the healthiest dogs in the world. They live longer. They're less inclined to get any genetic diseases. Many Iditarod dogs have run the Iditarod 10 times, and they've run other races too. So when PETA says that if an Iditarod dog runs the Iditarod, they're lucky to survive, they're crippled for life, well, they know that's not true. So they put out allegations knowingly that they're false. I mean, it's really unfortunate that they're not an organization interested in what's right for animal welfare.
To go from being a fan and maybe just a casual observer to where you are now, has it been a pretty steep learning curve, do you think?
Sure, learning every day, enjoying it, and still learning. You know, this will be my first Iditarod, so I still haven't been on the trail during the race as of yet. So looking forward to getting out to some of the villages this year, and I can't wait. So, you know, really learning a lot, listening as much as I can. So I think this is month five, and I'm still on a listening tour as much as possible. You know, listening to the mushers, listening to the dog trainers, listening to the people that make the booties and make the sleds, and our whole community. We have some really passionate people in our community, in our sport. A lot of really passionate volunteers have come back for year 19, year 20, year 21, and trying to listen to that experience, because I really think that the mission or our vision is, at least anyone that engages with the Iditarod, whether it's a fan, a sponsor, a musher, a supplier, we want them to reach their full potential and get the most return out of their engagement.
Tell me about this race series and remind me what the name of it is and what is that all about?
Sure. So there's an Arctic World Series sponsored by a brand called Krill. So it's called the Q Paws Series. And Krill is an additive from krill. It's like a shrimp that's put in the dog food for high performance. It's also for humans, you know, the high omegas, et cetera. There's supplements that are made out of krill. And they're making big inroad into a dog nutrition out of Norway. And they've sponsored a tour. We've aligned with three other races as a series of races. The first one starting coming up this weekend in Minnesota, the Bear Grease. Then there's a race in Norway. There's a race in Russia. And the Iditarod still being the grand finale. Now, it's still in its first year. We're still working through some of the kinks of this, because it's not as if you're a tennis or golfer and you can play every game on the series. You can't, it's pretty difficult to fly your teams of dogs around the world. So it's not a real practical way. So we're still working away, but ultimately it's going to be broadcast for mushing fans around the world. So for those that are like watching our Insider, they'll be able to see other races on our Insider telecast, broadcast. And then ultimately there could be, you know, bringing in the Yukon or the K300 and other races into this series so that we can create, you know, think about the mushing channel, whether it's right now on YouTube, but ultimately is it going to be on Discovery Channel.
I wanted to ask you about climate change. I mean, how is the Iditarod grappling with some of the issues we've seen? The course has had to be rerouted. There's been low snow. There's always a scare that there isn't going to be any sea ice kind of towards the end out there on the coast. How are you guys dealing with that?
You know, it's I'm learning. It's real. It's we're the poster child for climate change. In certain respects, I guess all Alaska can be considered an epicenter for it. Fortunately, this year we've got sea ice all the way in Nome, so we're good. We could run today from Willow to Nome without a problem. We got a lot of snow, but last year, you know, they had to bring the teams inland, never before happened, you know, well before Nome the finish, and it's a big issue for us. Certainly, there's millions of dollars and a lot of scientists spent studying this, so I don't have the answers. We'll continue to improvise. Number one will be safety for our mushers and our teams. We've had to change the course. I think there's been three starts in Fairbanks because of lack of snow locally down here. And, you know, it may be that maybe the norm going forward. But this year looks pretty good so far, and we're almost locked into that. But it's something that I've looked at. I think of something that we probably have a bigger responsibility to, because if you look at the institutional knowledge that we have from what it was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and there's a lot of people that are still around. I spoke to Mitch Seavey's father a couple of days ago, to Lance Mackey's father, Dick Mackey, a few days ago. All these old timers can tell you how different the weather patterns were out on that trail. So it's something that we're conscious of. It's something that we've offered to get some data for others in the scientific community to help in the process of better understand the dynamic.
And, you know, of course, as soon as we say climate change, it's going to drop down to 20 or colder below. And, you know,
extreme weather for sure, right? Yeah. And but no, it's clear. I think everyone in Alaska knows that maybe this winter is the exception that proves the rule. Everyone told me, oh, it's really mild now. Anchorage, and it's been, you know, 10 to 20 below a lot lately. But it's real. You know, I think, we really have a lot of institutional knowledge on climate change, and to the extent that we can participate in that global conversation narrative, we should.
As the race gets a little closer here, what are you most concerned about or most worried about? And then also, what are you most excited about? Maybe first, what are you most concerned about?
Safety and redundancy for that, the integrity of our trail. You know, our trail breakers, this is amazing. They go out, there's seven of them on snow machines, and they're putting in the trail. And they build ice bridges. I guess less will be needed. So they're clearing out, if there's wood, logs. My understanding of the problem is this year, there's so much snow up north that the moose, a lot of moose paws, I guess, kind of can be sometimes challenging for the dogs. So we have to, because the moose are, there's so much snow that they're on our trail. Instead of going next door to our trail, there might be 15 inches of snow, they're going to go on our trail, which is good and bad. So we want to make sure we don't have any moose incidents, and then the moose somehow chop up the trail a little bit, so it'll make it a little harder for the dogs. So safety, and we've got a great team. Mark Norman, who's raced in 84 and has been helping to produce this race, is amazing. Our trail breakers are, they go out there without any support. You know, at least the mushers have 26 checkpoints of support. They got to take all their food and fuel with them out there and make it to Nome. And it's quite a complex. They put in 15,000 trail markers. But if you have a storm and people get lost, you know, and we each have two trackers, so we got some redundancy. This year we have some help from the Air National Guard for support helicopters as needed, the civilian versions of the Blackhawks. I think I feel pretty good. I really feel really good. We want dog health being paramount, people health. So health of everybody is something that I'll be looking forward to everyone getting to Nome at the end of the race. I'm excited in general. I am in awe of the community that comes together to execute. I just think it's super complicated. You know, we have our ceremony start here. We move our ecosystem to Willow that overnight and set up our signage and our start, et cetera. And then we just go, and the race is 24/7. We've got people that are not sleeping for that whole week manning our command centers, you know, tracking every single racer, getting that signal off the course for Insider, posting these daily content. These guys are amazing, and they're out there on the trail. You know, the difference in a triathlon world is, you know, you do an Ironman race, it's a long day. It's 2.5 ocean miles, 112 on the bike at 20-mile marathon. But guess what? You know, at the end of the day, got a nice bed, nice meal, hot shower. It's not running all night long. You know, the course shuts off and everyone's getting a good night's sleep. So it's a real big stressor, I think, on our team, on production, on the veterinarians that are, you know, taking care of the dogs, checking dogs, and, you know, all weather conditions. I mean, I don't know how they do it. You guys might know how they get out there, you get your gloves off. It could be 40 below and blowing, and you might be up for 36 straight hours and still engaging and doing your job. So our people just execute. I'm really impressed by that.
That was the Iditarod's new CEO, Rob Urbach, who will see the first Iditarod under his leadership kick off with the ceremonial start in Anchorage. I'm recording this on Thursday. That ceremonial start is Saturday. That is also when our daily episodes of the Iditapod will start, and our reporter on the trail, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, heads out. I'm looking forward to hearing those tales from the trail again and a lot more here in the next couple weeks. I'll be back. I'm Casey Grove. Thanks for listening, and until next time, happy trails.